He's the one who said that. Must be fate. When Noonan dared to look up again, the monkey was already gone, and Gouda was sitting motionless, her mouth half open and her eyes empty, the cigarette in her fingers growing a long, crooked column of gray ash. He pushed his glass toward her and said, "Make me another, dear, and make one for yourself, and we'll drink." She flicked off the ashes, looked around for a place to throw out the butt, and threw it in the sink. "What's it all for?" she asked. "That's what I don't understand. We aren't the worst people in town." Noonan thought that she was going to cry, but she didn't. She opened the fridge, took out the vodka and the juice, and took a second glass off the shelf. "All the same, you shouldn't despair," said Noonan. "There's nothing in the world that can't be fixed, and believe me, Gouda, I have connections. Everything I can do, I will." Right now, he himself believed in what he was saying, and he was already going through the names, clinics, and cities in his mind, and it even seemed to him that he had heard something somewhere about a case like this, and everything turned out okay. He just needed to figure out where it happened and who the doctor was. But then he remembered why he came here, and remembered General Lemkin, and he recalled why he had befriended Gouda, and he no longer wanted to think about anything at all. So he made himself comfortable, relaxed, and waited for his drink. At this point he heard shuffling footsteps and tapping in the hall, and the vulture Burbridge's repulsive, especially under the circumstances, nasal voice. "Hey, Red, your old lady, I see, has a visitor. Here's his hat. If I were you, I wouldn't let that slide." And Redrick's voice. "Take your prosthesis, Vulture, and bite your tongue. There's the door. Don't forget to leave. It's time for my supper." And Burbridge. "Jesus, he can't even make a joke." And Redrick. "You and I are done joking. Period. Go on, go. Don't hold things up." The lock clicked open, and the voices became fainter. Apparently, they had both gone out onto the landing. Burbridge said something in an undertone, and Redrick answered. "That's it. That's it. We're done." Then Burbridge grumbled something again, and Redrick replied in a harsh tone. "I said that's it." The door banged. He heard quick footsteps in the hallway, and Redrick Shuhart appeared in the kitchen doorway. Noonan rose to greet him, and they firmly shook hands. "I figured it must be you," said Redrick, looking Noonan over with quick green eyes. "Oh, you've gotten fat, fatso, growing your ass in bars. Ah, I see you guys have been enjoying yourself. Gouda, old lady, make me one, too. I gotta catch up." "We haven't even started yet," said Noonan. "We were just going to, as if we could hope to get ahead of you." Redrick gave a sharp laugh, punched Noonan in the shoulder. "We'll see who's catching up and who's getting ahead. Man, I've been dry for 2 years. In order to catch up, I'd have to guzzle a vat." "Let's go, let's go. Why are we sitting in the kitchen? Gouda, bring us supper." He dived into the fridge and stood up again, holding two bottles in each hand with various labels. "We'll have a party," he announced, "in honor of our best friend, Richard Noonan, who doesn't abandon those in need, though there's nothing in it for him. Ah, Goodlin isn't here. Too bad." "Give him a call," suggested Noonan. Redrick shook his flaming red hair. "They haven't laid phone lines to where he is yet. All right, let's go, let's go." He entered the living room first and banged the bottles down on the table. "We're having a party, Dad," he told the motionless old man. "This is Richard Noonan, our friend. Dick, this is my dad, Shuhart the Elder." Richard Noonan, having mentally gathered himself into an impenetrable lump, stretched his mouth to his ears, shook his hand in the air, and said to the corpse, "Nice to meet you, Mr. Shuhart. How are you?" "You know, Red, we've already met," he told Shuhart the younger, who was digging through the bar. "We saw each other once, only in passing, however." "Have a seat," said Redrick, nodding at a chair across from the old man. "And if you talk to him, speak louder. You can't hear a damn thing." He put down the glasses, quickly opened the bottles, and told Noonan, "Go ahead and pour. Give Dad a little. Just a nip." Noonan poured in a leisurely fashion. The old man was sitting in the same position, staring at the wall. And he showed no reaction at all when Noonan pushed the glass toward him. Noonan had already adjusted to the new situation. This was a game, a terrible and pitiful game. The game was Redrick's, and he was playing along the same way that his whole life he had played along with the games of others. Games that were terrible and pitiful and shameful and wild and far more dangerous than this one. Redrick raised his glass and said, "Well, shall we begin?" And Noonan glanced at the old man in a completely natural manner, and Redrick impatiently clinked his glass against Noonan's and said, "Let's go, let's go. Don't worry about him. He won't let it get away." So Noonan gave a completely natural nod, and they had a drink. Redrick grunted and, eyes shiny, went on in that same excited, slightly artificial tone. "That's it, man. No more jail for me. If you only knew, my friend, how good it is to be home. I got money. I have my eye on a little cottage with a garden, no worse than the vultures. You know, I was planning to emigrate. I'd already decided that in jail. Why in the world am I staying in this lousy town? Let them all go to hell, I think. I get back. Hello, they banned emigration. What, did we all become contagious in the last 2 years?" He talked and talked while Noonan nodded, sipped his whiskey, interjected sympathetic curses and rhetorical questions, then started grilling him about the cottage. "What is it like? How much does it cost?" And he and Redrick argued. Noonan was proving that the cottage was expensive and inconveniently located. He took out his notebook and flipped through it, naming addresses of abandoned cottages that could be bought for a song, and the repairs wouldn't cost much at all, especially if they applied to emigrate, got denied by the authorities, and demanded compensation. "I see you've even gotten into real estate," said Redrick. "I do a little bit of everything," answered Noonan, and winked. "I know, I know. I've heard about your brothel business." Noonan opened his eyes wide, put a finger to his lips, and nodded in the direction of the kitchen. "Don't worry. Everybody knows about that," said Redrick. "Money doesn't stink. I finally really understood that. But picking Hamfist to be your manager, I almost peed myself laughing when I heard. Setting a wolf to guard the sheep. You know, he's a nut. I've known him since childhood." Here the old man, moving slowly and woodenly like a giant doll, lifted his hand from his knee and dropped it on the table by his glass with a wooden bang. The hand was dark, with a bluish tint, and the clenched fingers made it look like a chicken foot. Redrick fell silent and looked at him. Something trembled in his face, and Noonan was amazed to see the most genuine, the most sincere love and affection expressed on that savage, freckled mug. "Drink up, Daddy, drink up," said Redrick tenderly. "A little is all right. Please have a bit." "Don't worry," he told Noonan in an undertone, winking conspiratorially. "He'll get to that glass, you can be sure of that." Looking at him, Noonan remembered what had happened when Boyd's lab assistant showed up here to pick up this corpse. There were two lab assistants, both strong young guys, athletes and all that, and there was a doctor from the city hospital accompanied by two orderlies, coarse, brawny men used to lugging stretchers and pacifying the violent. One of the lab assistants described how that redhead, who at first didn't seem to understand what was going on, let them into the apartment and allowed them to examine his father, and they might have just taken him away like that, since it looked like Redrick had gotten the idea that Dad was being taken to the hospital for preventative measures. But when the knucklehead orderlies, who in the process of the preliminary negotiations had hung around the kitchen and gawked at Gouda washing windows, were summoned, they carried the old man like a log, dragging him, dropping him on the floor. Redrick became enraged, at which point the knucklehead doctor stepped forward and volunteered a detailed explanation of what was going on. Redrick listened to him for a minute or two, then suddenly, without any warning at all, exploded like a hydrogen bomb. The lab assistant telling the story didn't even remember how he ended up outside. The red-headed devil kicked all five of them down the stairs, not letting a single one of them leave unaided. On his own two legs, every one of them, according to the lab assistant, flew out the front door as if shot from a cannon. Two of them stayed unconscious on the pavement, and Redrick chased the remaining 3 or 4 blocks down the street, after which he came back to the inspector's corpse mobile and broke all of its windows. The driver was no longer in the vehicle. He had fled in the other direction. "I recently tried this new cocktail in a bar," Redrick was saying, pouring the whiskey. "It's called Hell Slime. I'll make you one later after we eat. That, my friend, is the kind of stuff that's hazardous for your health on an empty stomach. Your arms and legs go numb after one drink. I don't care what you say, Dick. Tonight I'll get you wasted. I'll get you wasted, and I'll get wasted myself. We'll remember the good old days. We'll remember the borscht. Poor Ernie's still in jail, you know." He finished his drink, wiped his mouth with the back of his hand, and asked in an offhand manner, "So what's new at the Institute? Have you gotten started on the slime? You see, I'm a bit behind on my science." Noonan immediately understood why Redrick was steering the conversation in this direction. He threw up his hands and said, "You kidding, pal? You know what happened with the slime? Have you heard of the Kerrigan Labs, this little private setup? Anyway, they managed to get their hands on some slime." He described the catastrophe, the scandal, how they never figured out where the slime came from. Never did clear that up. While Redrick listened in a seemingly absent-minded way, clucking his tongue and nodding his head, then decisively splashed more whiskey into their glasses and said, "Serves them right, the parasites. May they all go to hell." They had another drink. Redrick looked at his dad. Once more, something trembled in his face. He stretched out his hand and pushed the glass closer to the clenched fingers, and all of a sudden the fingers opened and closed again, grasping the bottom of the glass. "Now things will go faster," said Redrick. "Gouda," he hollered, "how long are you going to starve us?" "It's all for you," he explained to Noonan. "She must be making your favorite salad with the shrimp. I saw she's been saving them for a while." "Well, and how are things at the Institute, in general? Find anything new? I hear you guys have robots working their asses off, but not coming up with much." Noonan began telling him about the Institute business, and as he talked, the monkey silently appeared by the table next to the old man and stood there for a while, putting her furry little paws on the table. Suddenly, in a completely childlike manner, she leaned against the corpse and put her head on his shoulder. And Noonan, continuing to chatter, looked at these two monstrous offspring of the zone and thought, "My lord, what else do we need? What else has to be done to us so that it finally gets through? Is this really not enough?" He knew that it wasn't enough. He knew that billions and billions didn't know a thing and didn't want to know, and even if they did find out, would act horrified for 10 minutes and immediately forget all about it. "They'll get wasted," he thought savagely. "Screw Burbridge, screw Lemkin. Screw this star-crossed family, I'm getting wasted." "Why are you staring at them?" asked Redrick in a low voice. "Don't worry, it won't hurt her. On the contrary, they say they exude health." "Yeah, I know," said Noonan, draining his glass in one gulp. Gouda came in, ordered Redrick to set the table, and put down a large silver bowl with Noonan's favorite salad. And then the old man, in a single motion, as if someone had just remembered to pull the puppet strings, jerked the glass toward his open mouth. "So, guys," said Redrick in a delighted voice, "now we'll have one hell of a party." Chapter 4. Redrick Shuhart, 31 years old. During the night, the valley had cooled off, and at dawn it actually became cold. They walked along the embankment, stepping on the rotted ties between the rusty rails, and Redrick watched the droplets of condensed fog sparkle on Arthur Burbridge's leather jacket. The kid was walking lightly, cheerfully, as if they hadn't just passed a torturous night, full of nervous tension that still shook every fiber, as if they hadn't spent 2 agonizing hours on the wet summit of the bare hill and restless sleep, huddling together for warmth, waiting out the torrent of greenid that was flowing around the hill and disappearing into the ravine. There was a thick fog lying on both sides of the embankment. From time to time it rolled over the rails in heavy gray streams, and they would walk knee-deep in a slowly swirling haze. It smelled of damp rust, and the swamp to the right of the embankment reeked of decay. They couldn't see anything except the fog, but Redrick knew that on both sides stretched a hilly plain with piles of rocks, and that beyond that were mountains hidden in the haze. And he also knew that when the sun rose and the fog condensed into dew, he was supposed to see the frame of a broken-down helicopter to their left and a train in front of them. And that's when the real work would begin. As he walked, Redrick shoved his hand between his body and the backpack and jerked the backpack up so that the edge of the helium container didn't bite into his spine. The damn thing's heavy, he thought, and how am I going to crawl with it? A mile on all fours. All right, stop bitching, stalker. You knew what you were in for. 500 big ones are waiting for you at the end of the road. You can sweat a bit. 500,000, a tasty treat, huh? No way will I give it to them for any less than that, and no way will I give the vulture more than 30. And the kid? The kid gets nothing. If the old bastard told me even half the story, then the kid gets nothing. He took another look at Arthur and for some time watched, squinting as he lightly stepped over the ties two at a time. Wide-shouldered, narrow-hipped, the long raven hair like his sister's, bouncing in rhythm to his steps. He begged it out of me, Redrick thought sullenly. He did it himself. And why'd he have to beg so desperately, trembling with tears in his eyes? Please take me, Mr. Shuard. I've had other offers, but I only want to go with you. You know the others are no good. There's father, but he can't anymore, Redrick forced himself to cut this memory short. Thinking about it was repellent, and maybe that was why he started thinking about Arthur's sister. About how he'd slept with this Dina. Slept with her sober and slept with her drunk. And how every single time it had been a disappointment. It was beyond belief. Such a luscious broad. You'd think she was made for loving, but in actual fact she was nothing but an empty shell, a fraud, an inanimate doll instead of a woman. It reminded him of the buttons on his mother's jacket, amber, translucent, golden. He always longed to stuff them into his mouth and suck on them, expecting some extraordinary treat, and he'd take them into his mouth and suck, and every single time would be terribly disappointed, and every single time he'd forget about the disappointment. Not that he'd actually forget. He just refused to believe his memory as soon as he saw them again. Or maybe his daddy sicked him on me, he thought, considering Arthur. Look at the heat he's packing in his back pocket. No, I doubt it. The vulture knows me. The vulture knows that I don't kid around, and he knows what I'm like in the zone. No, I'm being ridiculous. He wasn't the first to ask. He wasn't the first to shed tears. Some have even gotten on their knees. And they all bring a gun the first time. The first and last time. Will it really be his last time? Oh, kid, it looks like it. You see, Vulture, how things have turned out. It's his last time. Yes, Daddy, if you'd learned about this idea of his, you'd have given him a good thrashing with your crutches, this zone-granted son of yours. He suddenly sensed that there was something in front of them, not too far away, about 30 or 40 yards ahead. Stop, he told Arthur. The boy obediently stopped in his tracks. His reaction time was good. He froze with his foot in the air and then slowly and cautiously lowered it to the ground. Redrick came up to him. Here the train tracks noticeably sloped down and completely disappeared into the fog. There was something there, in the fog, Something large and motionless. Harmless. Redrick cautiously sniffed the air. Yes. Harmless. Keep going, he said softly, waited until Arthur took a step, and followed him. Out of the corner of his eye he saw Arthur's face, his chiseled profile, the clear skin of his cheek and the decisively pursed lips under the thinnest of mustaches. They continued going down, the fog enveloping them to their waists, then to their necks, and in another few seconds the lopsided mass of the rail car loomed ahead. All right, said Redrick, and he started pulling off the backpack. Sit down where you're standing. Smoke break. Arthur helped him with the backpack, and they sat side by side on the rusty rail. Redrick opened one of the packets and took out the bag of food and the thermos of coffee. While Arthur was unwrapping the food and arranging the sandwiches on top of the backpack, Redrick pulled the flask from his jacket, unscrewed the cap, and closing his eyes, took a few slow sips. Want a sip? He offered, wiping the mouth of the flask with his hand. For courage. Arthur shook his head, hurt. I don't need it for courage, Mr. Shuhart, he said. I'd rather have some coffee, if you don't mind. It's very damp here, isn't it? It's damp, agreed Redrick. He put the flask away, chose a sandwich, and started chewing. When the fog burns off, you'll see that we're in the middle of a swamp. This place used to be swarming with mosquitoes. It was something else. He stopped talking and poured himself some coffee. The coffee was hot, thick, and sweet. Right now it tasted even better than alcohol. It smelled of home, of Gouda. And not just of Gouda, but of Gouda in her bathrobe, just awakened with a pillow mark still on her cheek. I shouldn't have gotten mixed up in this, he thought. 500,000. That'll do I need 500,000 for. What am I going to buy a bar? A man needs money in order never to think about it. That's true. Dick got that, right? But lately I haven't been thinking about it, so why the hell do I need the money? I have a house. A garden. In Harmont you can always find work. It was the vulture that lured me, the rotten bastard lured me like a kid. Mr. Shuhart, Arthur blurted out, looking off to the side, do you really believe that this thing grants wishes? Nonsense, Redrick said absent-mindedly. He froze with his cup halfway to his mouth. And how do you know what kind of thing we're here for? Arthur laughed in embarrassment, ran his fingers through his raven hair, tugged on it, and said, I just guessed. I don't even remember what gave me the idea. Well, first of all, Father always used to drone on about this golden sphere, but a while ago he stopped doing that and started visiting you instead. And I know you two aren't friends, no matter what he says, and he's become kind of strange lately. Arthur laughed again and shook his head, remembering something. And it all finally clicked when the two of you were testing this dirigible in the vacant lot. He patted the backpack at the place containing the highly packed envelope of the hot air balloon. To be honest, I'd been shadowing you, and when I saw you lift the sack of stones and guide it through the air, everything became completely clear. As far as I know, the golden sphere is the only heavy thing left in the zone. He took a bite of the sandwich, chewed, and said thoughtfully with his mouth full, The only thing I don't understand is how you're going to latch onto it. It's probably smooth. Redrick kept looking at him over the cup and thinking, How very unlike they are, father and son. They've got nothing in common, neither faces nor voices nor souls. The vulture's voice was hoarse, ingratiating, sleazy in some way, but when he spoke about this, he spoke well. You couldn't help listening to him. Red, he said then, leaning over the table, there are just two of us left, and there are only two legs between us, and they are both yours. Who'll do it but you? It might be the most precious thing in the zone, and who's going to get it, huh? Will it really be those sissies with their robots? Because I found it. And many of our men have fallen along the way, but I found it. I've been saving it for myself, and even now I wouldn't give it away, but you see, my arms have gotten short. No one can do it but you. I've trained so many brats, even opened a whole school for them. None of them can do it. They don't have what it takes. Okay, you don't believe me. That's fine. You don't have to. The money's all yours. Give me what you like. I know you won't cheat me, and I might get my legs back. My legs, you understand? The zone took my legs away, so maybe the zone will give them back again? What? Asked Redrick, coming to. I asked, may I have a smoke, Mr. Shuhart? Yeah, said Redrick. Go ahead, I'll have one, too. He gulped down the remaining coffee, took out a cigarette, and stared into the thinning fog. He's nuts, he thought. A crazy man. It's his legs he wants, that asshole. That rotten bastard. All these conversations had left a certain sediment in his soul, and he didn't know what it was. It wasn't dissolving with time, but instead kept accumulating and accumulating. And though he couldn't identify it, it got in the way, as if he'd caught something from the vulture. Not a disease, but instead strength, maybe? No, not strength. So what was it? All right, he told himself, let's try this. Pretend I didn't make it here. I got ready, packed my backpack, and then something happened. Say I got nabbed. Would that be bad? Yes, definitely. How so? The money down the drain? Nah, the money's not the issue. That those bastards Raspy and Boney would get their hands on the goods? Yes, it's something. That would be too bad, but what are they to me? Either way, they eventually get everything. Brrr, Arthur shivered, his shoulders convulsing. I'm freezing, Mr. Shuhart. Maybe I could have a sip now? Redrick silently took out the flask and offered it to him. You know, I didn't agree right away, he thought suddenly. 20 times I told the vulture to go to hell, but the 21st time, I did agree. I just couldn't stand it anymore. And our last conversation was brief and very businesslike. Hey, Red, I brought the map. Maybe you'd like to take a look after all. And I looked into his eyes, and his eyes were like abscesses, yellow with black dots in the middle. And I said, give it to me. And that was all. I remember I was drunk at the time. I'd been binging all week. I was really depressed. Oh, damn it, what does it matter? So I decided to go. Why do I keep digging through this as if poking through a pile of shit? What am I, afraid? He started. A long, mournful creak suddenly reached him from the fog. Redrick leaped up as if stung, and at the same time, just as abruptly, Arthur leaped up too. But it was already quiet again. Only the sound of gravel clattering down the embankment as it streamed from under their feet. That's probably the ore settling, Arthur whispered uncertainly, forcing the words out with difficulty. There's ore in the cars. They've been standing here a while. Redrick stared in front of him without seeing a thing. He'd remembered it was the middle of the night. He'd been awakened, horror-struck, by the same sound, mournful and drawn out as if from a dream, except that it wasn't a dream. It was the monkey screaming, sitting on her bed by the window, and his father was responding from the other side of the house, very similarly, with creaky, drawn-out cries, but with some kind of added gurgle. And they kept calling back and forth in the dark. It seemed to last a century, 100 years, and another 100 years. Gouda also woke up and held Redrick's hand. He felt her instantly clammy shoulder against his body, and they lay there for these hundreds and hundreds of years and listened. And when the monkey quieted down and went to bed, he waited a little longer, got up, went down to the kitchen, and greedily drank half a bottle of cognac. It was the night he started binging. The ore, Arthur was saying. You know, it settles with time. From the humidity, from erosion, for various other reasons. Redrick took a look at his pale face and sat down again. His cigarette had somehow disappeared from his fingers, so he lit a new one. Arthur stood a little longer, warily looking around, then sat down and said softly, I know they say there are people living in the zone. Not aliens, actual people. That they were trapped here during a visit and mutated, adjusted to new conditions. Have you heard of this, Mr. Shuhart?
Yes, said Redrick. Except that's not here, that's in the mountains to the northwest. Some shepherds.
So that's what he infected me with, he thought. His insanity. That's why I've come here. That's what I need. Some strange and very new sensation was slowly filling him. He realized that this sensation wasn't actually new, that it had long been hiding somewhere inside him. But he only now became aware of it, and everything fell into place. And an idea which had previously seemed like nonsense, like the insane ravings of a senile old man, turned out to be his sole hope and his sole meaning of life. It was only now that he'd understood. The one thing that he still had left, the one thing that had kept him afloat in recent months, was the hope for a miracle. He, the idiot, the dummy, had been spurning this hope, trampling on it, mocking it, drinking it away, because that's what he was used to, and because his whole life, ever since his childhood, he had never relied on anyone but himself. And ever since his childhood, this self-reliance had always been measured by the amount of money he managed to wrench, wrestle, and wring out of the surrounding indifferent chaos. That's how it had always been, and that's how it would have continued if he hadn't found himself in a hole from which no amount of money could rescue him. In which self-reliance was utterly pointless. And now this hope, no longer the hope, but the certainty of a miracle, was filling him to the brim, and he was already amazed that he'd managed to live in such a bleak, cheerless gloom.
Hey, Stalker, he said. Soil your underpants, get used to it, buddy. Don't be embarrassed. They'll wash them out at home.
Arthur looked at him in surprise, smiling uncertainly. Meanwhile, Redrick crumpled the oily sandwich paper, flung it under the rail car, and reclined on his backpack, leaning on his elbows.
All right, he said. Let's say we assume that this golden sphere really can. What would you wish for?
So you do believe in it? Arthur asked quickly.
Doesn't matter if I believe in it or not. Answer the question.
He suddenly became truly interested in what a kid like this could ask the golden sphere. Still a pipsqueak, yesterday's schoolboy. And he watched with a lively curiosity as Arthur frowned, fiddled with his mustache, glanced up at him, and lowered his eyes again.
Well, of course, legs for father, Arthur said finally. For things to be good at home?
Liar, liar, said Redrick good-naturedly. Keep in mind, buddy, the golden sphere will only grant your innermost wishes, the kind that if they don't come true, you'll be ready to jump off a bridge.
Arthur Burbage blushed, sneaked another peek at Redrick, and instantly lowered his eyes, then turned beet red. Tears even came to his eyes. Redrick smirked, looking at him.
I see, he said almost tenderly. All right, it's none of my business. You can keep it to yourself. And then he remembered the gun and thought that while there was time, he should deal with everything he could.
What's that in your back pocket? He asked casually.
A gun, grumbled Arthur and bit his lip. What's it for?
Shooting, Arthur replied defiantly.
That's enough of that, Redrick said strictly and sat up. Give it to me. There's no one to shoot in the zone. Hand it over. Arthur wanted to say something, but he kept his mouth shut, reached behind his back, took out a Colt revolver, and handed it to Redrick, holding it by the barrel. Redrick took the gun by the warm, ribbed handle, tossed it up in the air, caught it, and asked, "Do you have a handkerchief or something? Give it to me. I'll wrap it." Took Arthur's handkerchief, spotless and smelling of cologne, wrapped the gun in it, and placed the bundle on the railroad tie. "God willing, we'll come back here and pick it up. Maybe we really will have to fight the patrols, although fighting the patrols, buddy." Arthur adamantly shook his head. "That's not what it's for," he said with vexation. "It only has one bullet, in case it happens like with Father."
"Oh, I see," Redrick said slowly, steadily examining him.
"Well, you don't need to worry about that. If it happens like with your father, I'll manage to drag you here, I promise. Look, dawn is breaking."
The fog was evaporating before their eyes. It had already vanished from the embankment, while everywhere else around them the milky haze was eroding and melting, and the bristly domes of the hilltops were sprouting through the vapor. Here and there, between the hills, he could already make out the speckled surface of the soured swamp, covered with sparse, malnourished willow bushes, while on the horizon, beyond the hills, the mountain summits blazed bright yellow, and the sky over the mountains was clear and blue. Arthur looked over his shoulder and cried out in admiration. Redrick also turned around. The mountains to the east looked pitch black, while the sky above them shimmered and blazed in a familiar emerald glow, the green dawn of the zone. Redrick got up and, unbuckling his belt, said, "Aren't you going to relieve yourself? Keep in mind, we might not have another chance." He walked behind the rail car, squatted on the embankment, and, grunting, watched as the green glow quickly faded. The sky flooded with pink, the orange rim of the sun crawled out from behind the mountain range, and the hills immediately began casting lilac shadows. Then everything became sharp, vivid, and clear, and directly in front of him, about 200 yards away, Redrick saw the helicopter. It looked as if it had fallen right into the center of a bug trap, and its entire hull had been squashed into a metal pancake. The only things left intact were the tail, slightly bent, its black hook jutting out over the gap between the hills, and the stabilizing rotor, which noticeably squeaked as it rocked in the breeze. The bug trap must have been powerful. There hadn't even been a real fire, and the squashed metal clearly displayed the red and blue emblem of the Royal Air Force, a symbol Redrick hadn't seen in so long he thought he might have forgotten what it looked like. Having done his business, Redrick came back to the backpack, took out his map, and spread it on top of the pile of fused ore in the rail car. The actual quarry wasn't visible from here. It was hidden by a hill with a black and charred tree on top. They were supposed to go around this hill, on the right, through the valley lying between it and another hill, also visible, completely barren, and with reddish-brown rock scree covering its entire slope. All the landmarks agreed with the map, but Redrick didn't feel satisfied. The instinct of a seasoned stalker protested against the very idea, absurd and unnatural, of laying a path between two nearby hills. "All right," thought Redrick, "we'll see about that. I'll figure it out on the spot." The trail to the valley went through the swamp, through a flat, open space that looked safe from here, but taking a closer look, Redrick noticed a dark gray patch between the hummocks. Redrick glanced at the map. It had an X and the scrawled label, "Smartass." The dotted red line of the trail passed to the right of the X. The nickname sounded familiar, but Redrick couldn't remember who this smartass was, or what he looked like, or when he'd been around. For some reason, the only thing that came to mind was this. A smoky room at the Borscht, unfamiliar, ferocious mugs, huge red paws squeezing their glasses, thunderous laughter, gaping yellow-toothed mouths, a fantastic herd of titans and giants gathered at the watering hole, one of his most vivid memories of youth, his first time at the Borscht. What did I bring? An empty, I think. Came straight from the zone, wet, hungry, and wild, a bag slung over my shoulder, barged inside and dumped the bag on the bar in front of Ernest, angrily glowering and looking around, endured the deafening burst of taunts, waited until Ernest, still young, never without a bow tie, counted out some green ones. No, they weren't green yet. They were square, with a picture of some half-naked lady in a cloak and wreath. Finished waiting, put the money in his pocket, and surprising himself, grabbed a heavy beer stein from the bar and smashed it with all his might into the nearest roaring mug. Redrick smirked and thought, maybe that was smartass himself.
Is it really okay to go between the hills, Mr. Shuhart? Arthur softly asked near his ear. He was standing close by and was also examining the map.
We'll see, said Redrick. He was still looking at the map. The map had two other X's, one on the slope of the hill with the tree and the other on top of the rock scree, Poodle and Four Eyes. The trail went between them. We'll see, he repeated, folded the map and stuffed it into his pocket. He looked Arthur over and asked, are you shitting yourself yet? And not waiting for an answer, ordered, help me put the backpack on. We'll keep going like before. He jerked the backpack up and adjusted the straps. You'll walk in front so I can always see you. Don't look around, but keep your ears open. My orders are law. Keep in mind, we'll have to crawl a lot. Don't you dare be afraid of dirt. If I order you to drop face down in the dirt, no questions asked. And zip your jacket. Ready?
Ready, Arthur said hollowly. He was obviously nervous. The color in his cheeks had vanished without a trace.
We will first head this direction. Redrick gestured curtly toward the nearest hill, which was 100 steps away from the embankment. Got it? Go ahead.
Arthur took a ragged breath, stepped over the rail, and began to descend sideways down the embankment. The gravel cascaded noisily behind him.
Take it easy, said Redrick. No rush.
He carefully descended behind him, balancing the inertia of the heavy backpack with his leg muscles by force of habit. The entire time he watched Arthur out of the corner of his eye.
The kid is scared, he thought, and he's right to be scared. Probably as a premonition. If he has an instinct like his dad, then he must have a premonition. If you only knew, Vulture, how things would turn out. If you only knew, Vulture, that this time I'd listen to you.
And here, Red, you won't manage alone. Like it or not, you'll have to take someone else. You can have one of my pipsqueaks. I don't need them all.
He convinced me for the first time in my life I had agreed to such a thing. Well, never mind, he thought. Maybe we'll figure something out. After all, I'm not the Vulture. Maybe we'll find a way.
Stop, he ordered Arthur.
The boy stopped ankle-deep in rusty water. By the time Redrick came up to him, the quagmire had sucked him in up to his knees.
See that rock? Asked Redrick. There, under the hill.
Head toward it. Arthur moved forward. Redrick let him go for 10 steps and followed. The bog under their feet slurped and stank. It was a dead bog. No bugs, no frogs. Even the willow bush here had dried up and rotted. As usual, Redrick kept his eyes peeled, but for now, everything seemed all right. The hill slowly got closer, crept over the low-lying sun and blocked the entire eastern half of the sky. When they got to the rock, Redrick turned back to look at the embankment. The sun shone on it brightly. A 10-car train was standing on top of it,
A few cars had fallen off the rails and lay on their sides, and the ground beneath them was dotted with reddish-brown patches of spilled ore. And farther away, in the direction of the quarry, to the north of the train, the air above the rails was hazily vibrating and shimmering, and from time to time, tiny rainbows would instantly blaze up and go out. Redrick took a look at this shimmering, spat dryly, and looked away. "Go on," he said, and Arthur turned a tense face toward him. "See those rags? You aren't looking the right way over there, to the right." "Yeah," said Arthur. "That used to be a certain smartass a long time ago. He didn't listen to his elders and now lies there for the express purpose of showing smart people the way. Let's aim 2 yards to his right. Got it? Mark the place. See, it's roughly there where the willow bush is a bit thicker. Head in that direction. Go ahead." Now they walked parallel to the embankment. With each step, there was less and less water beneath their feet, and soon they walked over dry, springy hummocks. "And the map only shows swamp," thought Redrick. "The map is out of date. The vulture hasn't been here for a while, so it's out of date. That's not good. Of course, it's easier to walk over dry ground, but I wish that swamp were here." "Just look at him march," he thought about Arthur. "Like he's on Central Avenue." Arthur had apparently cheered up and was now walking at full pace. He stuck one hand in his pocket and was swinging the other arm merrily, as if on a stroll. Redrick felt in his pocket, picked out a nut that weighed about an ounce, and, taking aim, flung it at Arthur. It hit him right in the back of the head. The boy gasped, wrapped his arms around his head, and writhing, collapsed onto the dry grass. Redrick stopped beside him. "That's how it is around here, Archie," he said didactically. "This is no boulevard, and we aren't here on a stroll." Arthur slowly got up. His face was completely white. "You got it?" asked Redrick. Arthur swallowed and nodded. "That's good. Next time I'll knock out a couple of teeth, if you're still alive. Go on." The boy might make a real stalker, thought Redrick. They'd probably call him Pretty Boy. Pretty Boy Archie. We've already had one pretty boy. His name was Dixon, and now they call him the Gopher. He's the only stalker that's ever been through the grinder and survived. Got lucky. He, strange man, still believes that it was Burbridge who pulled him out of the grinder. As if... There's no pulling someone out of a grinder. Burbridge did drag him out of the zone, that's true. He really did perform that feat of heroism, but if he hadn't, those tricks of his had already pissed everyone off, and the boys had told Burbridge flat out, "Don't bother coming back alone this time." That was right when he had gotten nickname the Vulture. Previously, he'd gone by Strongman. Redrick suddenly became aware of a barely noticeable air current on his left cheek and immediately, without even thinking, yelled, "Stop!" He stretched his arm to the left. The air current was more noticeable there. Somewhere between them and the embankment was a bug trap. Maybe it even followed the embankment. Those rail cars hadn't fallen over for nothing. Arthur stood as if rooted to the ground. He hadn't even turned around. "Head farther to the right," ordered Redrick. "Go ahead." Yeah, he'd make a fine stalker. The hell, am I feeling sorry for him? It's just what I need. Did anyone ever feel sorry for me? Actually, yes, they did. Kirill felt sorry for me. Dick Noonan feels sorry for me. To be honest, maybe he doesn't feel sorry for me as much as he's making eyes at Gouda, but maybe he feels sorry for me, too. One doesn't get in the way of the other in decent company. Except that I don't have the chance to feel sorry for anyone. I have a choice. him or her. And for the first time he became consciously aware of this choice. Either this kid or my monkey. There's nothing to decide here. It's a no-brainer. But only if a miracle is possible, said some skeptical voice in his head, and feeling horrified, he suppressed it with frantic zeal. They passed the pile of gray rags. There was nothing left of Smartass, only a long, rusted-through stick lying in the dry grass some distance away. A mine detector. At one point, mine detectors were in heavy use. People would buy them from army quartermasters on the sly and trusted in them as if they were God himself. Then two stalkers in a row died using them in the course of a few days, killed by underground electrical discharges. And that was it for the detectors. Really, who was this Smartass? Did the Vulture bring him here, or did he come by himself? And why were they all drawn to this quarry? Why had I never heard of it? Damn, it's hot. It's only morning. What's it going to be like later? Arthur, who walked about five steps ahead, lifted his hand and wiped the sweat from his brow. Redrick looked suspiciously at the sun. The sun was still low, and at that moment it struck him that the dry grass beneath their feet was no longer rustling, but seemed to squeak like potato starch, and it was no longer stiff and prickly, but felt soft and squishy. It fell apart under their boots like flakes of soot. Then he saw the clear impressions of Arthur's footprints and threw himself to the ground, calling out, "Get down!" He fell face first into the grass, and it burst into dust underneath his cheek, and he gritted his teeth, furious about their luck. He lay there, trying not to move, still hoping that it might pass, although he knew that they were in trouble. The heat intensified, pressed down, enveloped his whole body like a sheet soaked in scalding water. His eyes flooded with sweat, and Redrick belatedly yelled to Arthur, "Don't move! Wait it out!" and started waiting it out himself. And he would have waited it out, and everything would have been just fine. They would have sweated a bit, but Arthur lost his head. Either he didn't hear what was being shouted to him, or he got scared out of his wits, or maybe he even got more scalded than Redrick. One way or another, he stopped controlling himself, and letting out some sort of guttural howl, blindly darted, hunching over back to where they came from, the very place they had to avoid at all costs. Redrick barely had time to sit up and grab Arthur's leg with both hands, and Arthur crashed heavily to the ground, squealed in an unnaturally high voice, kicked Redrick in the face with his free leg, and wriggled and flopped around. But Redrick, also no longer thinking straight from the pain, crawled on top of him, pressing his face into Arthur's leather jacket, and tried to crush him, to grind him into the ground. He held a twitching head by the long hair with both hands and furiously used his knees and the toes of his shoes to pound Arthur's legs and ass and the ground. He dimly heard the moans and groans coming from underneath him and his own hoarse roar, "Stay down, asshole, stay down or I'll kill you!" while heaps of burning hot coal kept pouring on top of him and his clothes already blazed and the skin on his legs and sides crackling, blistered and burst. And Redrick, burying his forehead in the gray ash, convulsively kneading the head of this damn kid with his chest, couldn't take it any more and screamed as hard as he could. He didn't remember when the whole thing ended. He just noticed that he could breathe again, that the air was once again air instead of a burning steam scorching his throat, and he realized that they had to hurry, that they had to immediately get away from this hellish oven before it descended on them again. He climbed off Arthur, who lay completely motionless, squeezed both of the boy's legs under his arm, and using his free hand to help pull himself along, crawled forward. He never took his eyes off the boundary where the grass began again, dead, dry, prickly, but real. Right now it seemed to be the most magnificent place on earth. The ashes crunched between his teeth, waves of residual heat kept hitting his face. Sweat poured right into his eyes, probably because he no longer had eyebrows or eyelashes. Arthur dragged behind him, his stupid jacket caught on things as if on purpose.
Redrick's scalded ass burned, and each movement caused his backpack to slam into the back of his scalded head. The pain and oppressive heat made Redrick think with horror that he'd gotten thoroughly cooked, and he wouldn't be able to make it. This fear made him work harder with his free elbow and his knees, forcing the vilest epithets he could think of through his parched throat. Then he suddenly remembered with some kind of insane joy that he still had an almost full flask inside his jacket. "My dear, my darling, it won't let me down. I just need to keep crawling a little more. Come on, Redrick. Come on, Red. A little more. Damn this zone. Damn this waterless swamp. Damn the Lord, the whole host of angels. Damn the aliens, and damn that fucking vulture." He lay there for a while, his face and hands submerged in cold, rusty water, blissfully breathing in the rotten stench of the cold air. He'd have lain there for ages, but he forced himself to get up on his knees, took off his backpack, and crawled toward Arthur on all fours. The boy lay motionless about 30 feet away from the swamp, and Redrick flipped him onto his back. Yeah, he'd been one good-looking kid. Now that cute little face appeared to be a black and gray mask made of ashes and coagulated blood, and for a few seconds Redrick examined the lengthwise furrows on this mask with a dull curiosity, the tracks of hummocks and rocks. He stood up, lifted Arthur by the armpits, and dragged him to the water. Arthur was wheezing and from time to time moaning. Redrick threw him face down into the largest puddle and collapsed next to him, reliving the delight of the cold, wet caress. Arthur started gurgling and thrashing around, put his arms underneath him, and raised his head. His eyes were popping out of his head. He didn't understand a thing and was greedily gulping air, spitting out water, and coughing. Finally, his gaze became intelligent again and fixed on Redrick.
"Oh," he said and shook his head, splattering dirty water. "What was that, Mr. Shuhart?"
"That was death," Redrick mumbled, and lapsed into a coughing fit. He felt his face. It hurt. His nose was swollen, but strangely enough, his eyebrows and eyelashes were intact. And the skin on his hand also turned out to be okay, just a bit red. "I guess my ass didn't get burned to the bone either," he thought. He felt it. No, definitely not. Even the pants were whole, just like he'd been scalded with boiling water. Arthur was also gingerly exploring his face with his fingers. Now that the horrible mask had been washed away by water, his face looked, also contrary to expectations, almost all right. A few scratches, a small gash on his forehead, a split lower lip, but overall, not too bad. "I've never heard of such a thing," said Arthur, and looked around. Redrick also looked around. There were lots of tracks left on the ashy gray grass, and Redrick was amazed by how short the terrifying, endless path he had crawled to escape destruction had apparently been. There were only 20 or 30 yards, no more, from one end of the scorched bald patch to the other. But fear and inability to see caused him to crawl in some sort of wild zigzag, like a cockroach in a hot frying pan. And thank God that at least I crawled in the right direction, more or less. Or else I might have stumbled onto the bug trap to the right, or I could have turned around entirely. No, I couldn't have, he thought fiercely. Some pipsqueak might have done that, but I'm no pipsqueak. And if not for this idiot, nothing would have happened at all. I'd just have a scalded ass. That'd be the extent of it. He took a look at Arthur. Arthur was sputtering as he washed up, grunting when he brushed the sore spots. Redrick got up, and wincing from the contact between his heat-stiffened clothing and his skin, went out onto the dry patch and bent over the backpack. The backpack had really taken a beating. The upper pockets were completely scorched. The vials in the first aid kit had all burst from the heat, and the yellowish stain reeked of disgusting medicine.
Redrick had opened one of the pockets and was raking out the shards of plastic and glass when Arthur said from behind his back, "Thanks, Mr. Shuhart. You dragged me out." Redrick didn't say anything. "Screw you and your thanks, just what I need you for, saving your ass."